We're going to get started. We're still a few short of a quorum for the division. I apologize. The hour 12:30 has now come and gone by 10 minutes, and I want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to provide their testimony this afternoon. We're going to get started, and there's a lot of people running around the Capitol today, a lot of constituents. I know that both Representative Hamilton and Pepin were in their office with constituents as I came up, so I believe they're going to be here momentarily. I will officially call the meeting to order once we have a quorum of our members here. And thank you to the members of the Jobs Committee and the Ag Committee. Is anybody on Ag? Not yet. But I think Representative Davis is with constituents as well, and I know he was hoping to be here. We're going to start with a brief presentation from Ray Frost and Don Gerhardt regarding the recent events with MinBio and Medical Alley. So welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself to the tape.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon. My name is Ray Frost. I am now the Senior Vice President for Medical Alley / MinBio. We put together what I think is a really good agenda here for you today. We're going to start with just this quick update, and then Doug Ashright from Shamonics, Dr. Levine from the University of Minnesota, and then two other folks from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Leslie Miller and Dr. Georgopoulos, who will close it out for us today. But I just wanted to bring you guys up to speed, since Don and I have presented in front of your committee before on a recent announcement of a merger between MinBio and Medical Alley, just to kind of show our commitment with this. And with that, I just want to turn it over to Don, since he's the CEO, and just kind of give folks a quick update as to what we're going to be doing, some of the small activities we're going to be undertaking in the next 6 months to a year. So,
Mr. Garrett. And Chair, it really is a pleasure to talk with you today to give you indications of the coalescing in Minnesota, probably best indicated by the merging of MinBio and Medical Alley effective March 1st with the intent of industry, and I mean in the industry, all of the infrastructure that is in Minnesota. So it is the industrial manufacturers, it is the caregivers, it is the scientists, the educational organizations, etc., are coming together inside this new Medical Alley MinBio to form an organization that has well over 500, pretty close to 600 member companies and member organizations, and will employ somewhere between 250 and 300,000 Minnesotans. We will be doing a whole number of things early on to impact both the economy of the state, as well as get in parallel lines certain kinds of both information and activity that will be helpful to you as legislators to understand what is going on in the industry. We feel very strongly that Minnesota can be and should be one of the key areas in the world for bioscience and life science. So that's where we're headed, and Ray and I will be working on that together.
And the other reason, Mr. Chair, some of you might be wondering why we're telling you this, is because many of you have probably heard when Don and I have testified, or those who've been around here for a long time, the last 2 years, with all the bioscience talk, we've talked about convergence in Minnesota, that Minnesota can be the center for convergence. Well, what we're doing is what we're talking about. And what Sermonix will present to you today will show you some dynamics in that convergence center that we think Minnesota could potentially be a leader on. And that's the convergence of the medtech and kind of the biotech industries as a whole coming together. So with that, I want to turn it over to Doug Ashright, who's general manager over at Sermonix for diagnostics and drug delivery, if I can.
Thank you. And as Mr. Ashright comes forward, I will call the division to order. We have a quorum. And there's minutes from the last meeting and members' packets. Representative Scripps moves the minutes of the February 10th, 2005 meeting of the division. Any additions, corrections, deletions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. Mr. Ashright, could you please, or members, in your packets, there's an article from the Star Tribune that ran on February 16th discussing the merger of Medical Alley and MinBio, so that's in members' packets. Ms. Graystrike, could you please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Doug Atri, and I'm a general manager of one of the four business units at Surmodics. We'll talk more about Surmodics in case you're not everybody might be familiar with it. But also, until a week ago or so, I was president of MinBio. With the merger, I merged my way out of a job, which was part of the deal. And so I'm really excited about the merger and the reasons for the merger. And what I want to do today is I want to talk primarily about Surmodics, but I want to try to tie in this convergence, which is easy to talk about, because Surmodics is actually a company that's living it, and I think we have great opportunities in Minnesota. Before I start about Surmodics, let me talk a minute about the my view of a convergence of industries, which is going to be profound for Minnesota. In the past, these three big areas, pharma, biotech, diagnostics, and medical devices, were separate. They were separate for a reason, because there was no need for them to be together. Once you were diagnosed, we probably diagnosed you after you had the disease. We treated the symptoms of the disease, and further diagnostics wasn't any help. Because so you found out you had cancer, you got treated the same way everybody else got treated for cancer. With the emergence of biotechnology and genomics and all those fancy words, we've begun to understand the basis of disease. And so now we're not going to treat everybody the same way. We're going to get the right medicine to the right person in the right concentration, and that's around personalized medicine. And I won't go into more details about that, but so there's this intersection between diagnostics and the pharma company. There's also an intersection between the medical device industry, where, you know, clearly Minnesota is an absolute leader, worldwide leader. Medical devices used to be pieces of metal we put in the body to take care of whatever problem. What we understand now is that the combination of drugs and devices is going to provide better therapy. So there's that intersection. Clearly, this occurrence is taking place. Now, MinBio and medical AI could have merged or not merged. This is going to take place regardless. This is profound for Minnesota, clearly, because people have asked about why biosciences in Minnesota. This is why biosciences in Minnesota, because we lead in medical devices, and we're good in those other places. So these areas of intersection where there's opportunities is fertile for Minnesota. It's also where Surmodics literally and figuratively makes our business. And let me talk about Surmodics. Surmodics is a company in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. It's on the NASDAQ, trades on the NASDAQ, and I'll talk more about these other things. A bit about the history of Surmodics. It's almost exactly 25 years old, this is not very good projection, but I'll point out, what you see is for the first 10 years it was run a bit like a science project. We did what we could do with SBIR grants. We got over 100 SBIR grants, over $26 million, so, you know, tax dollars at work. And that was important. We would not have survived, though. And so we did what we could do, we could write grants for. That changed in the early 90s when we actually started. We identified what our real market should be, and that is coding medical devices, and I'll talk a bit about that. So some key timelines for us are just a couple. One is the deal we struck with Johnson & Johnson to code to make a drug-eluting stent, which was actually introduced in 2003. That's a big deal, as I'm sure you're aware of, especially because Boston Size is also a competitor in that area. The timeline is interesting because the first 10 years was quiet, doing a lot of research, and we actually became a real company, a commercial company over the last 10 years.
You're publicly trading. Can I ask, are you making money?
Yes. I'll show some financials. It's a very profitable situation. There are about 150 people at Surmodics, as I said, and we're located in Eden Prairie. What we do is we don't make devices, we don't make drugs, but we coat devices. We're a little like the BASF. They don't make cars, they make cars brighter. They make the color brighter. And so what would you want to do with a device? Well, so we coat devices for lots of different companies. These are some of our partners. Those names are pretty recognizable. A lot of Minnesota companies because of the device. Big companies, little companies. We have 71 different licensed customers for our coatings.
Representative Laffer, did you have a question now, or did you want to wait?
Sorry. The question I had, and maybe they'll address it later, is that you had, and our guest was, I was intrigued by the patents as we're trying to understand sort of how we compete nationally, internationally. I was surprised by the international number of patents was twice that of the U.S. roughly. And is there a different patenting process for foreign patents versus U.S.? And
The process is slightly different. Some of those numbers could be because they're patented in different countries. They may be, and then also the time frame of patents could change when they were filed, when they come off patent. So that might be the variation. Patents is a critical area because our business model is. I'll talk about what we do, but our business model is: if you made a device and you came in and said, "I want it coded because I want this function on the coding." We'd work to develop that coding, but you make the device, so we would transfer the coding to your manufacturing facility. So we get paid because we sell you a little bit of chemistry, but we really get paid because it's a proprietary coding, and so it's a license. So that these licenses are really important. And so patents are what really makes us valuable. So we code...
Excuse me, Goodwin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amount this is going to cost is about $26 million in tax cuts?
I'm sorry. I was being a little... Over the past 25 years since we started, we've been primarily funded, and we were funded as a startup primarily through SBIR grants, through the federal government, small business grants. Over that time, and we're done doing that now because we're frankly too big a company to get SBIR grants. Over that time, we got over 100 of those grants from the federal government, worth over $26 million. That's how we funded ourselves. We had no venture capital. We funded ourselves primarily through SBIR grants. That's what I was talking about. That's past. That's over.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Am I to understand then that there is something you want the state to do to help you here?
Representative Goodwin, we asked MinBio and Medical Alley asked Mr. Astray and Sermonix here, along with the other testifiers today, to provide essentially an overview. We've talked a lot in the committee so far about kind of the human health stuff. Obviously, Sermonix deals with that, but we're going to be hearing from the university and some of the other areas where bioscience is currently being applied. Essentially, another overview. Mr. Astray isn't here asking the committee for anything. We don't have a bill before the committee. Next week, we'll talk about this at the end. Next week, we will have a couple bills before the committee. So essentially, we wanted to bring in a company to basically talk about what's happening in the industry. So he's here as a representative of the industry. If that's helpful.
Thank you.
So what kinds of coatings do we put on? One is hydrophilic coating. That's a $3 word for them saying slippery. Right? So obviously if you put a catheter in somebody's body, and everybody knows people that have catheters, angioplasties, they're all catheters. They go in all over the body and they have to be delivered through the body. Obviously if it's slippery, it's going to be easier to slip through the body. So we coat things that are slippery. And you see this picture here of these two tubes. One obviously... you can see the one with bubbles, that's obviously repelling the water, and the other one's got a clear coat of water, so that's a slippery coating. So we coat things to be slippery. We'd also coat them to be accepted in the body better. You wouldn't want something to clot on your catheter. So here's the top two catheters, the top two tubes have been coated and then put in a blood in the body. You can see there's no clotting, the bottom one hasn't been coated. So we can put different functions on it, because it really is where a piece of material like a catheter, like a tube, comes in contact with the body. The interface is important, and we are working at that interface to make sure that they're biocompatible. Another area that we're doing is we have a partner called NovaCell, which is doing islet cell transplants. People with diabetes, islet cells make insulin. And so people that are diabetics have a problem with their islet cells. So one approach to solve that is by isolating islet cells and then injecting them into people to do an islet cell transplant. The problem is, and we're not doing that work, but the problem is this interface again. You have to put these cells back in somebody else's body. and we need to take care of the cells. So what our part is, you can see the islet cell in the middle, our part is the coating around the outside. We coat the islet cells, which allows nutrients in to keep the islet cells alive. It keeps antibodies out so it doesn't get rejected, but allows insulin to come out for long-term treatment of diabetes. So again, we're working with this company. Our part is the materials part, and so that's another area we're doing. The area that's thrived over the last couple of years has been most noted about is drug delivery, and this has to do with that convergence we just talked about. So this is a little picture. Just drugs and devices, and together they create better healthcare. And we're the carrier in between. People use our coatings to put their drug on a device.
Are you the drug dealer?
No. Right. This doesn't show. The reason to do that, this doesn't show very well. What I was trying to show was why would you want to deliver to the right location? Again, it's to get the shaded yellow area. Imagine that's the level of drug you need in a tissue to be effective. What you can't see is a white line that starts high and goes through that effective area and then drops. That would be a systemic drug. So if you needed a drug specifically to one area and you took a pill, you'd take a lot of medicine, it would go through the whole body, and for a short period of time in the area where you wanted it, you'd get the right dose and then it would drop off. By doing site-specific drug delivery, you're getting the right amount to the right area and not getting the other tissues involved. And so the bottom line shows we start with a lower dose, but we're putting it in the area and releasing it at the right rate in the tissue where we need it. So that's sort of the basis for drug delivery. And the one that's been the wild success has been stents. Everybody knows people have stents put in their body. Stents are put in to open where there's, and you can see the top one where there's the artery or the vein was collapsed. So they put the, it's just a piece of wire that they put in and they blow it up so it opens up. It opens it up. What they've learned is if they put a drug on it, it not only opens, it keeps it open. So the rate, if you put a bare metal stent in, the rate of it closing up again is about 25%. With the drug, the rate of closing up is about 5%. Profound difference. So we don't make the drug that keeps it open. We don't make the stent, but we put the coating on the stent with the drug in it, which releases it in the right time frame. Okay, so we're living at that interface. The three circle somatic literally lives at that interface between drugs and devices. There's well over 5 million of these have been put in the last 2 years. And again, it's the other area, this is kind of a new area for somatics, is ophthalmology. What we did was, I cringe when I talk about this, delivering drugs to the eye is a really difficult deal, getting drugs to the back of the eye for macular degeneration. And as people like me get older and older, seemingly faster, there's an increase in this disease. So delivering the drug, they have some drugs that work, delivering the problem. So they deliver now by injection. So you get an injection, a month later you've got to get another injection because the drug goes away. So we bought a company that had a delivery system, which is a little corkscrew that will be screwed in the eye, and I cringe when I say that. But what it does is then for months, maybe years, slowly delivers the right amount of drug. So again, it's the drug delivery of the stent. I won't talk much about, this is actually the business unit that I run, and we actually make some products. The entry on the left is a slide, it's a glass slide, like a microscope slide, which is about an inch by 3 inch. We coat it with a surface to allow people to print genes on it, pieces of DNA. You may have read in the paper things about gene chips. People put a whole human genome on that slide, 40,000 different spots of different genes on that slide, which is going to lead to that personalized medicine. And I don't need to go into more detail. But again, what I do in my business unit isn't any different, except it's not the body. It's still a piece of glass that we're putting some biological molecule on. It's still at an interface between biology and some material. So I use similar kinds of technologies. Just an idea of the track record. So I told you Surmodics is 25 years old. This shows the revenue on the left in 2004 is just under $50 million. You can see the operating margin. You joked about being a drug dealer. There are drug dealers making less margin than that. So, but you know, I told you about our business model. Primarily, it's a licensing model. And so we don't actually make stuff. We make the chemicals. So obviously, been very successful. Cash flow, diluted earnings per share. So this is Surmodics is a you know, is arguably a success story. And I think it's important here because not only because it's a Minnesota company doing well and in this area and they intend to grow, there's a reason we're in this area. It started here, but I just, you know, we are a company that literally is working at that convergence, and I think it's profound for Minnesota, and obviously it's important to us as well.
Mr. Esser, Representative Mahoney has a question. Representative Mahoney?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, could you speak, and hopefully I'm not going over something that you've gone over in your committee at another time, and I want to thank you for the invitation. The Bio 101 is an important part and a huge growth industry for our state. It has great potential. But no 101 should ever go by without some conversation about how you finance your business, and your angel investors, and you know, your company's 25 years old. At what point did you start becoming profitable? And go to an actual venture capital, and then at what point you ended up being able to stock market?
Most of the money came from these small business grants. Okay, $26 million over. You know, we're not doing it now, but roughly 25 years. And everything else was angel. We never went to the venture market. Everything else was, I say we. I was at 3M for a long time. I wasn't at Sermonix when I did this, but the history is, they had some angel investors. Our friends of Dale, our CEO is Dale Olseth, who was also a one-time CEO of Medtronic and CEO of Tonka Toys, actually. And so I don't mean that facetiously, but he had friends with money, and so that helped generate. I would argue that model is hard to reproduce because I don't think today you could start and run a company for 10 years without making a profit, living at the edge like that. Technology is developing too rapidly to do that. So I don't suggest that, you know, here's Sermonix that did it without venture capital. There are a lot of other. I think that's a difficult thing to do today. But that's how we did it, and we didn't get to be profitable until I got to go back to the thing. I think it was 98. Our growth, our financial growth, it is really a hockey stick growth with a big leg because for 15 or 20 years it was nothing. And then we hit, you know, we finally understand what the focus should be. And it's everything is a time and space thing. This convergence that we keep hearing about, it happened, and we were sitting in the right spot. And companies are finally successful sometimes because of time and space. We had the right technology at the right time at the right spot.
Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one thing I didn't understand, you said you coat things that are slippery.
We coat things to make things slippery.
Okay.
So if you could imagine a Teflon tube isn't really slippery, and if you had to put that into the body, it would be difficult to maneuver it. So our surface coating makes it very slippery. And that's part of. So we're putting stuff on the surface which changes the function.
Which makes it slippery.
Representative Mulroy.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Did you do that to certain politicians here?
Mr. Esser, you don't have to respond to that question unless you want to.
No, wait, you told me I should guard my political rhetoric.
Can you take your advice from Ray?
No.
Any other members have questions? Mr. Esser, thank you very much for coming down. Thank you for the good work you're doing in the inquiry, and we appreciate your testimony today. I understand that Mr. Musclet could not be here. However, there is someone here in his place. Why don't you come forward and... Are we done with the... Are we going to use the laptop here?
We are.
Okay, great. Could you please identify yourself,
Alan Levine?
Thank you, Mr. Levine.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Alan Levine. I'm the head of the Department of Food Science and Nutrition at the University of Minnesota, and I'm representing myself from the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives initiative, which I co-chair the operating committee of at the university, which is one of President Brunick's initiatives, and also representing Vice President Musclet. Yeah. So I'll get our slides ready here. I'll just mention that the biosciences for a healthy society are a very, very important part of President Brunig's request. His biannual request is entitled that, and it involves four interdisciplinary initiatives. This is just one of them, the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives initiatives. We're going to be hearing from others who represent some of the other initiatives. As you know, the biosciences, broadly defined, are very key to Minnesota's future success and vitality. That's why we're talking about it today. We have a very strong foundation to launch the state into a leadership position that will result in cutting-edge research, new products, highest quality professionals in the workforce, new businesses, and overall economic development and prosperity. In addition to the strengths that you'll hear from other speakers today, and you've heard some already, I wanted to just briefly highlight some of the examples of the science that's emanating from your research institution, from the University of Minnesota, that leverages opportunities for many of the Minnesota companies, the entrepreneurial businesses, and the endeavors in the public sector. So I'll highlight briefly some of the details on these contributions in the biosciences area, but I want to emphasize the point that ultimately all of our biosciences capabilities in the state address three key areas. One is the health of the Minnesota citizens, two, the health of our landscape, and three, the health of our economy. And all the biosciences ultimately address the quality of life. And these biosciences are integrated. You can't really separate them very well. They integrate across disciplines. One sure way to achieve gains in the biosciences is to invest in the University of Minnesota. I'm not trying to be selfish. I'll give you four reasons that emphasize the timeliness of this. I'd say the time is right for such an investment. The place is right, the state is ready, and the nation is ready. So the time is right. So there isn't a day that you go by that you don't open up a newspaper, that you don't see a headline talking about obesity. Obesity in children, there's compelling incidence data on heart disease, concerns about health care coverage for families, and there's lots of diet-related diseases. So to give you an idea associated with this, there's many, many, many diseases that are affected by diet. For example, cardiovascular disease, bone disease, cancer, diabetes, kidney disease, liver disease, arthritis, and hypertension. And I mentioned obesity as part of the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives. Obesity is, in fact, an extremely important part, affects all of these diseases in many ways. You don't think about bone disease as something with obesity, but when you lose weight, you lose bone. So it's a threat when you lose weight at that level. Most of the time we talk about the benefits. Well, why do you eat? Anybody in this room want to answer these questions? The first one should be hunger, right? But it turns out there's all of these reasons. If we had food in here, you know, free food, you would be eating it, maybe, perhaps. It's fun and it tastes good. When you go across the world on airplanes and you're tired of doing nothing, you get food, so you get rid of the boredom. But I just wanted to show you a few graphs to tell you the prevalence and the problems associated with obesity. So here are the states in 1985. And what you see in white, there were no data yet. In light blue, less than 10% of the population was considered to have a body mass index over 30. That would be equivalent to 30 pounds overweight for a 5'4" woman. And 10 to 14% in blue. These are results from telephone interviews. As you know, in telephone interviews, when we ask you your weight, you generally don't tell us you weigh more than you do. You usually say less than you do. So this probably underrepresents the problem. So I'm going to set this on automatic pilot, and you can watch Minnesota, of course. We'll just watch the country over the next period of time here. You'll see bluer and bluer colors coming in here. And as we continue on, there'll be a new category showing up shortly that will be the 15 to 20% or 19%. And you see more states coming through on this. And as we continue down this pathway, we'll get a new category shortly in the late 90s. We're greater than 20% of the population.
Now we're starting to look like a presidential map.
Yeah, you got it. These maps were created before that. And now we have 25%, and three states have joined in the 25, greater than 25%. So if you want to know why we're talking about an obesity epidemic, in fact, there are some scientists out there who are speaking about it being virally mediated. Not many of us believe it. Most of us believe it's an environmentally mediated phenomenon due to the fact that we have more food than we need, at spending only 10 to 12% of our annual budget on our food supply, on eating.
Has the methodology stayed the same? Are you still doing telephone interviews to collect this data?
This has all been gathered through a series of studies done under the auspices of the CDC. These are still telephone. So you can see that the time is right to invest in this issue. There's no way we can continue to ignore this. Another issue of great interest is foodborne illness. Everyone's had somebody in their family or themselves have an exposure.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to get too far off track with the bio 101, but there is still some concerns about how we determine what constitutes obesity, and there's some questions about where you start from your model. So although these are serious issues that need to be addressed, there's a lot of room for academic debate. Am I right?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. The issue has been somewhat controversial, not terribly, because there was some overrepresentation by CDC on this in some of the interpretation. However, it is clear that 66% of the population has a body mass index in the overweight range, which is greater than 25, and there are threats associated with that. Okay, and 5% of the population has severe obesity, which is a BMI greater than 35 to 40. So those kinds of data. Thank you. So another issue of great importance, and I'll be showing you some slides related to this. I'm integrating two talks, so if it doesn't flow perfect, you'll know why. There's some foodborne illness that we've all been exposed to at some point. You find that you probably won't eat a banana again if you were vomiting the next day after you remember eating the banana, but it might not have been the banana. It might have been the E. coli in the hamburger that wasn't cooked well. The statistics on these issues are staggering. We have to act now, and the place is right. Minnesota is the right place. The state is really ready. We have partnerships that are going on now, the Governor's Biosciences Initiative, the University Mayo Clinic Partnership, which the Obesity Center, I'll talk about at the University of Minnesota, is involved with the Mayo in this. There's state support for the Cargill Building for Microbial and Plant Genetics in partnership with Cargill. And the continuous ability of the state to access the university is a unique purveyor of quality research. And our university is really unique in this area. I'm sure you've heard this over and over. Our university has, in one place, it has all of the medical areas that we're interested in. It has veterinary school. It has public health, agriculture. All of these are represented on one campus. That there's only a few universities in the country that have that. The other reason is, aside from having a unique land-grant institution here, we're surrounded by 400-plus food companies with some of the major giants in this area as well. Prominent agribusiness, you know about this, a noted healthcare system, of course, and strong medical device and bio-based technology companies. So the state is truly ready, and the nation is ready, because you've heard about all of these issues. The National Research Council, the National Academy of Sciences, the former Secretary of Department of Health and Services, USDA's Under Secretary Jen, former Secretary Veneman, they've all been interested in they visited land-grant institutions, and we hosted an obesity program with Undersecretary Jen here last year, so there's been a lot of interest in this. And the biosciences for a healthy society are one of the real elements in the healthy, one of the real elements is the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives Initiative, so I'll speak in a little bit of detail about that. I mentioned the obesity. The university is trying hard to acquire more and more investigators and funds in this area. The Minnesota Obesity Center is a center that I direct that is 10 years old. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health. We go in for competition again. Cross your fingers. We'll get it again. More recently, the university internally funded a new obesity prevention center. These two together form the beginnings of an obesity consortium. The medical school is putting dollars in that direction as well, and we'll have a major consortium over time. I just wanted to say a few things about a subject known as nutrigenomics. This is part of the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives. Really what the science of nutrigenomics is talking about is how the molecules that we eat affect our genes. They actually can change our genetic profile, not the profile itself, but the expression of those genes. So now we talk about omics. Have you heard about omics? We talk about genomics, of course. Well, we have nutrigenomics, epigenomics, nutritional transcriptomics, proteomics, metabolomics. And these now make up a new science. There's actually a journal that's out there now called Omics. It's, you know, jargon establishes itself and carries on. So the omics then say, can what you eat affect how you feel? Well, it turns out we have investigators at the University of Minnesota, for example. Lloyd Metzger, who runs a dairy center at the university, has been doing some work showing that in cheese, there's ACE inhibitors. I want to see if I have that. Yeah, an ACE inhibitor. Some of you may use it as a drug. Angiotensin converting enzyme is an enzyme that takes angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2 and causes an increase in blood pressure. If you have hypertension, you can take an ACE inhibitor to treat that hypertension. Well, they're naturally occurring ACE inhibitors that look like this, but we don't have to talk about them, in cheese. It turns out that when we make cheeses, we cause the production of some of these. The question then becomes, does eating cheese, if we had more of these ACE inhibitors in them, cause a change in blood pressure? Well, those are the kinds of studies that one could do. Dan Gallagher at the University of Minnesota is taking a look at some of the components in broccoli that might lower your risk of colon cancer. It turns out the cruciferous vegetables that we've heard about over time contain these compounds that are anti-carcinogens. And so it may be important from that viewpoint to be eating your broccoli, etc. The consumption of soy products have been shown to lower risks of various types of cancer, particularly in terms of breast cancer, and Mindy Kurzer has been doing work at this at the university. These compounds, there are naturally occurring compounds in soy that compete for the absorption of what are the normal estrogens and then can have an effect on breast cancer as well as other types of cancer. Soy products can also lower some of the risks associated with cardiovascular disease. And that's why we're trying to integrate. In fact, the department that I'm in and chair, the Food Science and Nutrition Department, has two faculties. One group have been food scientists, the other group nutritionists. What we're trying to do is change that whole focus and make it one group that integrates the agricultural issues, the food issues, the social science issues, and the nutrition issues. And that's why our new moniker for that department, our new motto, is the science of healthy foods. We don't want to have two separate faculties. We want to be doing it that way. Soy, I mentioned in cardiovascular disease, there's a whole series of bioactive food components, and people are getting more and more interested. When I go to experimental biology meetings this year, I'll be hearing a lot on the bioactive food components. So Joanne Slavin has shown grape extract is involved in the reduction of cardiovascular disease. I talked about some of the soy isoflavones. Even wild rice has some components in it that may have effects, and beneficial effects, in terms of cardiovascular disease. And also CLA, which is conjugated linoleic acid, but we're talking about components in foods that may lower cancer risks. And there's a big emphasis, you've heard about it, you see it in campaigns on television from food companies, about whole grains. There's benefits associated with whole grains in terms of cardiovascular disease. There's less evidence on weight management, but more and more folks are doing those types of things. So the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives initiative is a very important way of taking a look at this, and that's why it's part of it. The other thing to mention, I talked to you about diseases, foodborne illness. Well, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, the good bacteria are the ones that ferment your products, be it your cheese or other fermented yogurt, that make the foods healthier, better, more stable in terms of shelf life. But then there are these other organisms like E. coli 0157 that we've heard so much about, and other microbes that are terribly dangerous and can cause major illness across the country. And there are viruses that are transmitted through foods. There are parasites that are transmitted through foods. So there's a whole series of things that can happen along those. And there's been a whole series of outbreaks over time that I'm sure you've heard about, a number of them. But things like Listeria monocytogenes in cabbage, it's not been broadcast that much, but that can happen. You can carry hepatitis in lettuce and raspberries and strawberries. We hear a lot about that first, E. coli, but we don't hear about the others as much. I would like to tell you that the University of Minnesota from the Department of Homeland Security this past year has, and this is just a quote from the reference when it was first announced, we got a $15 million grant. This grant is coordinated across campuses. It's at the Academic Health Center. It's also in the College of Agricultural, Food, and Environmental Sciences. It's in the Veterinary School. It's in the School of Public Health. So this is a $15 million grant, not only our university, but many universities associated with that. So there's unprecedented opportunities right now to use foods in a way, as Chuck Muscoplatt often likes to say, I don't want to just see bright red tomatoes that look better, that taste better, but are healthier for you, that have components in them, bioactive components that can impact that. So we have a whole series of things. I also wanted to mention another award that we got for Yoni's disease. The University of Minnesota received a USDA award at $8.8 million in grants over 4 years for research on Yoni's disease, which is caused by Mycobacterium avium, for those of you who remember your microbiology or are interested. We also got a series of dollars, $10.8 million, from the National Science Foundation involved in the sequencing genome of a model legume that was awarded in October of 2003. We'd like to also mention the Center for Microbial and Plant Genomics, where there's research ongoing associated with the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives. A few other initiatives in this request, for example, the biocatalysis initiative. Everybody in here know what biocatalysis is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Top of my head.
Well, if you remember, catalysts or enzymes are things that make reactions go quickly or quicker. Mm-hmm. And so if we can take the naturally occurring enzymes or catalysts that are in biological systems, like in cells, we can take those engineering processes that are occurring and help make other products and take them outside and engineer other systems that are using these naturally occurring components. So biocatalysis is one of the initiatives. It enables renewable resources like the forest, the grasslands, and the wheat and corn raised by farmers to become the raw materials for production and energy needs. So it's a whole new area.
Members, there will be a test on that. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is this the process for biomass production for the corn stock that we talked about, reducing that into biomass material by just the corn kernels themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's one of the processes that can be used towards that. It's not the single process. Biocatalysis is leading us in towards those directions of being able to do that, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just sitting here thinking about, you were talking about 40 pounds overweight and that they were all dangerously obese or something. I was thinking some of us may feel good because that would mean that Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was Mr. Olympia, was mostly obese. And some of us have never achieved that. So would this look better, I guess, if he was mostly obese.
Is there a question there, or is that kind of a comment?
He's wishing.
I guess a comment.
I'll respond to that comment quickly.
Dr. Lemme.
Yeah. What you're speaking to is when we say overweight, that's an estimate on a population basis. You're right. You could be 40 pounds overweight and have a lot of muscle mass on you. So we don't go in there and weigh you underwater. That's the way you would find out how much body fat you have. Or do even a skin caliper, because we're measuring millions of people when we do that. So when you go into your physician, they measure your weight and your height and come up with an index. If you were all muscle, I think they could tell when you took off your clothes. But there are issues related to that. So it's not a perfect system. It's a public health way of measuring.
Representative Mahoney.
All the academia is good. I mean, it's important and it has a great value to it. But maybe you could help me figure out help the committee understand how this translates into jobs, and particularly in the food science, jobs in the ag industry, and how we do value-added products so that our farmers don't have to have 1,000 head of cattle to make a living. They could maybe make a living on 500 and maybe take a vacation or something, or pay for their kids' college or whatever it might be. Or get my other chairman to quit yelling at me about the opulence of the metro area, but I won't talk to you. Which committee chair that was?
Dr. Levine. Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. It's not a simple issue, that question. It's multifaceted. Yes, we train people in the food science area who are going to go out there and work with the food companies at making things more efficient and more readily available. We also train people at the university who are working with the agricultural community in terms of production of these issues. But these new areas, and, you know, many times I speak with industrial groups that want a response to this. You know, they want to make an investment and 6 months later have a turnaround. This is very much of a long-term investment. If you asked a question about some disease processes 30 years ago, you would not believe that we could be able to treat them the way we are now. So I think the investment in this type of enterprise is not an immediate turnaround. So you're not going to see an instantaneous change. But if we make a product that we know is going to have a longer shelf life, that's going to make a difference in terms of production issues as well. You won't be having as much spoilage and throwaway. So radiation of fruits and vegetables and seeds and, you know, spices have been controversial at some level, but have really changed the way we deal with some of that.
Representative Mahoney.
Just one final few comments on it. Technology is generally fairly expensive, particularly high-tech technology. How do we as a legislature or you as a university or research institution keep the cost down so that it's not just the General Mills or whatever, the food giants, I don't want to say anybody's name because I might get wrong, the food giants have the capital to invest versus, you know, Bob Smith out in southwestern Minnesota or wherever. How do we keep that cost down, or how do we do that?
So that
farm rural costs. The last one, but
I didn't hear.
Rural farm costs, he said. But I do have some other suggestions on how we as a body of lawmakers can look to invest our money so that our rural communities, you know, have more. I love them, but they're moving to the city too far, and then they, you know, they expect me to do all these ag issues, you know, for their cousins back home. I got confused.
Oh, Representative Mahoney, it's the taxpayers' money, but it's a great question. It's not our money, it's taxpayers' money, but that's a great question, and Dr. Levine, if you can address that, I'd appreciate some insight there, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yeah, if I'm understanding you right, you're saying how can we decrease the cost of some of the technology associated with it? In fact, the technology is not necessarily super expensive at the level of producing some of the simple food items. Otherwise, we couldn't be charging the public only 10 to 12% of our budget in order to doing that. Some of the and there isn't sufficient investment at some level, in our estimation, in some of the new technologies that could develop, because unlike if you look at the pharmaceutical industry as a model, they spend a tremendous amount on R&D. In the food industry, we don't spend as much on that whole issue. But in terms of the community, how you make it less expensive is by taking a close look. For example, we have a pilot plan where we work towards the development of new products. We can then academically publish that material that will make it less expensive for somebody to work with it, and we work with the community on producing some new technologies to do that at a less expensive means. But in terms of a direct answer to that, I don't have one, to be honest. You know, because I don't see it as a large expense in investment of dollars. I think the community folks can do it as well. It doesn't have to be major.
Certainly something that your committee should, and all of our committees should look at.
Absolutely. Dr. Levine, we've heard some discussion in this committee in earlier presentations about what one of the, I'll call them one of the food giants, is doing. And I believe it's in partnership with the Mayo Clinic, but that's the Hormel research that's being done. I believe, and if you can speak to it even in general terms, what it is that Hormel is doing in terms of some of this food research. I believe it's related to cancer, and is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the Hormel has been working for a long time with specific kinds of fatty acids. For example, they have a great history in terms of the essential fatty acids and all of that. And they're working with some of the components that are involved in foods that could have effects on cancer. So, yes, they're cooperative ventures along with the Mayo and with the University of Minnesota with not only the Hormel. So, in general terms, yes, these integrated it's been great that we got some funds for the Rochester Mayo connection to the University of Minnesota, but what's also happened is organizations with connections with food industry as well. But the Hormel has two. It has the corporate and it has the foundation level where there's some scientific studies that are done outside of the corporate level.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So at this point, I just wanted to emphasize to end is that ultimately, once again, all of the bioscience capabilities in the state address three key areas. Okay, so we're back to the health of the citizens, the health of the landscape, and the health of the economy. And we believe that all of the biosciences ultimately address the quality of our lives. And all of these efforts together are integrated. The University of Minnesota system brings together all regions of the state. I'll summarize that and conclude with, through its coordinate campuses, it has five research and outreach centers, its extension service network, the unique facilities such as the Cloquet Forestry Service Center, the Itasca Biological Research Station, and the Hormel Institute, which is what I was speaking to rather than the corporate. A long-standing focal point for nationally renowned integrated research. The research, education, outreach embedded in our university initiatives, which we think of as the three I's, they're integrated, they work broadly together, they are integration, interdisciplinary, and of course, importantly, intentional. So I'm glad to take any other questions, and that would summarize what I had to say.
Representative Rothman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Levine, I'm wondering to what degree you're working with the School of Public Health in that synergy, because even if we have good, healthy foods, the burden is, as it always has been, to have the self-discipline to choose those and use them and make them a part of your diet. And I think that's an area of expertise of the School of Public Health, which is changing community norms and influencing those public choices.
Dr. Levine?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, the School of Public Health is absolutely integrated. When I talked about the obesity centers, there's two of them, and one is located in the School of Public Health. And I'm in two different colleges in our department. We work together all of the time. And we have people in the School of Public Health who are working on the school lunch program, along with an applied economist right now, Ford Runge, who is in the College of Agricultural, Foods, and Environmental Sciences. So nobody's left out of this picture at all. Food and health is such an important issue. I just talked to the chair of marketing, who is hiring somebody who has an interest in impulse control. So not only for shopping, but for food. So that there's
shopping. My teenage daughter.
I'll say that we have almost an environment with an embarrassment of riches, whether it be food or cars or shopping for other things, and we do have to use impulse control, or what we use the term willpower, to decide not to take that.
Dr. Levine, I know this isn't precisely your area, but Chairman David's just walked in the room, the chair of the Agriculture Committee here, and as I understand it, the U has undertaken a number of efforts really focused not just the food sciences, but agricultural sciences. Can you speak even in general terms to kind of what's going on at the U? There was Representative Severson earlier mentioned the product that Cargill has developed, and I don't know if that started with some university research years and years ago, but what else in general terms even, and again, I'm kind of putting you on the spot because I know this isn't your area, but if you could address that a little bit.
Okay, Mr. Chair. These agricultural sciences at the university are spending a lot of efforts, as I said, this is Vice President Dean Muscat-Platt's focus is towards taking the food system and making it healthier and affecting environmental sciences at the same way. So the way we deal with our soil systems, the way we deal with our overall environmental, is all integrated into this. They're not sitting alone anymore. In fact, the whole readdressing of the strategic plan at the university is around the idea of integrating all these barriers and silos we're trying to get away from. So yes, the agricultural sciences are addressing these issues directly. They're not, and my department is in that school as well as in other schools. So,
thank you. Representative Zellers.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Levine, thank you so much for the information. I was wondering, as long as there's no proprietary value in the numbers you were using, if you could provide that you can just shoot us an email if you'd like, but when we go out and discuss, sometimes people don't believe us that childhood obesity or obesity in general is really a problem, and I think it would help us. We had a discussion in tax committee just yesterday about how we were told by someone looking to change the tax code that obesity wasn't really something that people are worried about or that is a problem in society. So we'd love to have some information for us as we go forward.
I'd be happy to send that.
Great.
And also, I'll mention if you go to cdc.gov, those slides with the maps of obesity are downloadable from that website. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Levine, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Next, we have Dr. Miller from the Cardiovascular Division at the U.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dr. Leslie Miller. I'm the director of the Cardiovascular Division at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here to talk to you a bit about that interface of biotechnology. It certainly is a rich history at the University of Cardiovascular Medicine and Science. The whole medical alley, as it's referred to, 500 biotech firms, has been a very rich collaboration. Many of those companies have been spawned by innovation and creativity in cardiovascular research at the university. 50 years ago, the whole area of open heart surgery was pioneered there. It's a phenomenal history of cardiovascular science there. Hopefully, I'll give you a sense of the new wave of science that's going on there that leads to a lot of subsequent investment. I hope this slide catches your attention because it's some rather sobering information that why we believe that investment in cardiovascular medicine and science is one of the most compelling challenges and needs. It's now surpassed infection as the world's leading cause of death. Countries like India and China and so forth have now become epidemic developments of cardiovascular disease. For the past 100 years, it's been the leading cause of death in this country. It's the leading cause of loss of work and disability. The incidence of this disease increases with advancing age, and clearly as this aging population advances, it's going to become an even more dominant cause of disability and problems in our health, and clearly in need of serious investment. I'm going to overview some of the areas that we are trying to focus on at the university as a source of investment and hopefully a sense of pride and excitement about where we're going. This is a look as a chart showing over time in various age groups, and I think you can see with advancing age, this is a percentage of the population affected by cardiovascular disease in orange males and yellow females. And these are rather sobering statistics that over 65, two-thirds of the population will develop cardiovascular disease, and over 75, nearly 75% of the population. As we get more and more people aging, such as this graph showing the number of people over 65 years of age, in the next 20 years will double. There'll be over 65 million people over the age of 65 with a 65% chance of having cardiovascular disease. There's no disease category more important in the health of this country than cardiovascular disease. I'm going to show you an A to Z approach at the university that we think we're very sophisticated and high-tech, but we have really drawn a focus on heart disease prevention. I could be giving you the same set of slides 10 years from now if we don't start talking about heart disease prevention. I think the comments about obesity, comments about diabetes, another rampant illness, all influencing the impact of cardiovascular disease. We've developed a heart disease prevention center at the university, which is known nationally, now internationally. It's a community access focus. It has developed 13 new diagnostic tests that are really pioneering work in the field to non-invasively assess people on a graduated risk basis for detecting cardiovascular disease earlier. We've changed entirely the threshold for initiating treatment when we find cardiovascular disease, and this is a longitudinal effort because to make the case now of treating differently than we have in the past has to be proven, an evidence-based approach, and will be a while getting that done, but the government and hopefully the state will find the importance of investing in these strategies. One of the most important things we're now doing is a new science, as you heard about the omics. Well, genomics is something that we're now able to screen people with, and what we're trying to do in this clinic finding people at a primary basis that are there to be screened for a risk of heart disease without known disease, is are there genes we can identify that you're at 45 and have a heart attack? What about your kids? Can we pick them up very early on, identify their carriers of genes we know predispose them to developing atherosclerosis, and initiate therapy even in their 20s so they don't recapitulate at 50? Yeah, just like my dad, I had my heart attack. That's not acceptable. We've got to do better. This is looking at a second area of emphasis that you'll hear a lot about from the university soon. This is a look at mortality trends for cardiovascular disease, and the orange bar are the males, and that would be looking as a very good news story, and we are reducing the deaths from cardiovascular disease. But unfortunately, look at the course in women. We really are beginning to understand how huge an impact cardiovascular disease on women. It is the number one cause of death in women. If you look at the cause of death compared to other situations, when you look at coronary heart disease and add stroke to that, there are almost 1.5 million events, cardiovascular events, per year. Here's breast cancer at 200,000 events a year. Not only is this the number one cause of death, one in two women will die in the United States of cardiovascular disease, whereas there's only a 1 in 30 chance of dying of breast cancer. If you ask women, educated women in the populace today, what are they going to die of? Two-thirds of them will say breast cancer. And it's 15 times more likely they'll die of cardiovascular disease. This campaign is really going to roll out to the public to understand the importance of this. Strategizing, women are underserved, they have more symptoms, they die more often from an infarct, they die more often suddenly. All these things have really come to light in the last 5 years. The university is very fortunate. There are seven NIH-designated centers of excellence in women's health. The university is one of them. And the cardiovascular program here is second to none in the United States. We are going to roll out this campaign to the public in Minnesota about the impact of cardiovascular disease.
Dr. Miller, it sounds to me like we somewhere along the line really missed the ball. Can you? Is there any? Yeah. Has there been anybody looking into why we missed the ball? Where we missed it?
It is important, Mr. Chairman. I think that it's an honest observation that when we've done trials in all aspects of cardiovascular disease, it's been in men. It's been in Caucasian males, and we've looked back on this. And the NIH created an office in 1994, the Office for Women's Health Studies, and they have now mandated as you go forward, if you get federal funding, you have to include a certain number of women in this. The most recent trials they funded were the women's hormone replacement therapy. We made the observation with heart disease, particularly coronary disease, that menopause was the break point. Estrogens were protective, and then coronary disease took off dramatically and was a really big cause of death. Well, they said, well, why don't we just give women estrogen support therapy all through their life, and we'll abrogate this big rise in cardiovascular disease. In fact, it not only didn't help, it had an adverse impact. And that's the first time we really did a trial in several thousand women that we're focusing, and there are many trials going forward now, and I think your point is very accurate, that we didn't understand the impact of this disease on women until we stopped and took a look, and it's very sobering information. But I think the good news is we are very aware of this information now and doing a lot to try and change that. Sudden cardiac death.
Dr. Miller, I'm sorry. Representative Lieberman, you have a question?
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. I want to slow you down a little bit. You're a little past actually where I wanted to talk about. But going back to some of what you said earlier about cardiovascular disease being a leading cause of death, and I think you made the statement that no disease category is more important. And I don't want to be negative on what you're saying. I mean, I do accept the importance, and I was aware that the leading cause of death in women is cardiovascular disease and all of that. But I guess what I am concerned about is sometimes I see these charts, like your chart where the number of women is going up.
Mm-hmm.
And those aren't, at the same time, we know that our population is aging. And so when we talk about what's an important cause of death, I guess, you know, you have to die of something, right? And we have to die of something. So I guess what concerns me is that we look at these a little bit perhaps out of context because, you know, we may have 75% of people may die of cardiovascular disease, but if they're 90, then I'm, as a legislator, I'm not as worried about it and not as willing to devote the resources to it as I am if they're younger people who are losing productive years and all of that. So I wonder if you could put it in a little more context for us of maybe the age-adjusted, you know, I mean, it's not, surely it's not the leading cause of death for people at 30. And I doubt that it is at 50. Or maybe I'm wrong about that.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. This is the prevalence of the disease in different age groups, and I think you can see that it is relatively uncommon as a cause of death under the age of 45, and then the incidence and prevalence and cause of death goes up rather dramatically. As I said, two-thirds of the people over 65 will have this disease. It is the average age of myocardial infarction is 63. That's where all these people are subsequently being infected with cardiovascular disease that represents a risk of death. There's kind of an age cutoff that at 75 or 80, if you don't have coronary artery disease, your likelihood of dying of that is rather small. Stroke becomes more of an issue. I think your point is well made, and we're very cognizant of where to put resources where we can change the quality of life. But if women are living to an average age of 82, they're going to be more subject to this. It's the quality of your life, the morbidity of a stroke, the morbidity of a disabling heart attack, the healthcare resources we apply to that, it really will impact the healthcare economy as well as the quality of life of people. So we try to use our resources judiciously and not try to put all of the high tech into a population that's a reasonable quality of life and expectation for length of life. But what we're talking about is a population that is in the prime of their life or in an early, very functional retirement age that we think it's a very appropriate use of resources.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'm not disagreeing. You know, I want to make that really clear, you know.
I appreciate that.
But, I just need that context because, you know, as you can imagine, everybody comes to the legislature and you know, wants all the money to deal with all of their things. And, certainly in the health area, you know, there are some difficult choices that have to be made, so it'd be good to kind of keep these things in a little bit of perspective.
I would certainly admit to a ready bias, but I do think that those numbers stand indisputably that the number one cause of death in this country for 100 years. It isn't, and we don't mean to in any way suggest that breast cancer isn't a terribly devastating disease or any other forms of illness or disease, but we're talking about the number of people affected, the number of loss of work productive days, the number of healthcare dollars spent. This is the disease we have to do better with. And I think that's going to need some investment. So this is another unfortunate situation in the country. This is probably an underestimate that 250,000 people die suddenly. We know that our resuscitation efforts are not as effective as we like, whether it's even in the hospital or out of the hospital. There have been really well-published recommendations for how to do this, but one of our researchers was very interested in this sobering why we don't resuscitate people more effectively and literally developed an innovative device that helps with how you do chest compression and how you inflate the lungs. The usual rate was to say that it's, you know, 1 to 2 that you should compress the chest about 70 times a minute and breathe them about 20 times a minute. The new science says that you probably need to breathe them twice a minute and compress the chest 100 times a minute. He's developed a biotech company spinoff from that original research at the university that is probably going to change the entire national recommendations for how we do this, that almost tripled the survival of cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So this is a very simple but a very good example of someone with a creative, insightful research that led to a spinoff, that led to a whole company being spun off of that simple technology that is the Minnesota company based on University of Minnesota research. Heart failure is another major illness. You may or may not be very cognizant about this. 5 million people in the United States, as I suggested, this is a worldwide problem. This is a disease of older people, that escalating age over 65. We think that perhaps 15% of the population over 65 will be affected with heart failure. And when we double that number of patients, it's going to be a huge healthcare problem in the next 5 to 10 years. 500,000 new cases a year. When you look at who gets hospitalized today, this is the number one cause of hospital admission and discharge. It's the number one cause of readmission. We have a patch. We don't really change natural history. It's a very sobering condition, and this population will make this an even bigger problem in the future. We've done a lot at the university, and we've pioneered a lot of the approach with drug therapy. The certainly Medtronic guidance and the pacemaker industry here in the Twin Cities has been at the center of the development of pacemakers to help treat this. We'll show you newer, more mechanical devices that are capable of helping this. We've been a dominant center in heart transplantation, but the two areas that I hope to draw your attention as really exciting areas for the university is stem cell therapy. So I'll show you an interesting story that horses have asthma, and asthma is typically, as you see people, they take an inhaler. Well, there's not an inhaler that horses can use very effectively, and so they made a liquid formulation. And when they gave this liquid formulation, an asthma drug, to these horse owners, they came back and the veterinarian said, well, how did that work? And they said, well, you know, it really, they must have had more asthma than I thought, because they're really doing well. And he said, well, like how well? Well, a lot of them are quarter horses, and they began winning races where they were not very competitive before. And what they also noticed was that the musculature in these animals changed rather dramatically. This is a drug called clenbuterol. It's a very fascinating story that we led that the heart is a skeletal muscle, just like in the periphery. Well, it became so obvious that people who were showing horses, they had to develop a blood test because they were just giving the horse this drug empirically to make them look sculpted and win competitions. Well, the beef industry said, you can give a drug and I get more muscle. Well, you can see the advantage of that. And so the beef industry got it. Finally, the agricultural business said that's no longer allowable. Olympic athletes found that they, even at that level of caliper, found this was the performance-enhancing drug. In 1992, there were seven athletes taken out of competition. It's now banned as the performance-enhancing substance. So a very wise investigator, a colleague of mine in London, began to give this to people who had heart failure. Their hearts weren't contracting well and said, can we make that muscle get better again, in fact? And in fact, we're the second center in the world to investigate this drug that looks like a totally new and promising approach to treating heart failure based on an observation in horses and from veterinarians. This is a new device that we refer to as a ventricular assist device. This is for people who are in refractory shock. The heart has the blood drained into a mechanical pump. This functions as a bellows and compresses the blood and simulates what would happen in the heart and pumps the blood out to the rest of the circulation. These pumps have gone dramatically forward in terms of their simplicity. They're now powered by two sets of electrical batteries. Many of you, when you think about mechanical pumps and total artificial hearts, remember the terrible tragedies of strokes and thrombosis. We now have developed this roughened surface that you can see underneath that forceps. It looks like the inside of your own blood vessels. These people now take one aspirin a day for anticoagulation, and strokes are a rarity anymore. So a lot of progress in the management. But we hold now a golf tournament for our patients who are waiting for a transplant. You can see pictured here in the white is the actual pump in a holster-type apparatus. Some of them are actually even more resuscitated. This is a man who was literally pronounced dead from a devastating heart attack, had the pump put in emergently, went back to farm in Minnesota with a fairly substantial amount of equipment, and underwent successful heart transplant where he surely would have unfortunately expired of his heart attack.
His pump was powered by a Caterpillar?
Yeah, Caterpillar battery. So I'll try and move through the rest of this as quick as I can. This is, I think, just a picture that to me says it all. This is a gentleman 4 years after he's had a pump in, as a destination as not getting a transplant. This is his pump for life, and I think he looks like the epitome of Minnesota health and vigor 4 years later. The pumps are getting smaller. This is about the size of a flashlight battery in the lower right. And I'll go through that. We're doing a lot of science that we are able, when we put that pump in, we get a big piece of tissue. When it comes out of transplant, we get another piece of tissue, and we can really compare the gene expression in these patients. This is I'll just go through for the sake of getting to the thing I want you to know about. University of Minnesota is known internationally around the world as one of the premier centers in stem cell therapy. We think this is the future of cardiovascular medicine and therapy. It's an institute that was founded about 4 years ago, and since that time, we've now focused as a subdiscipline the Center for Cardiac Repair and Vascular Repair and Recovery. There are trials, first in the United States, that are about to start at the university, we hope in the next several months, treating patients with acute heart attacks, heart failure, coronary artery disease and chest pain, peripheral vascular disease and strokes. This is done by taking insulin, expanding it in culture, putting it into a bag, and then injecting it. If we do this in an open situation, this is what we do in animals. We put the stem cells right into the area of the heart. This is just proof that we took, around the white is all scar from a heart attack. In the middle are new cells making new muscle fibers.
In Germany, is this all adult stem cell based?
Or? Yes, it is. This is not embryonic at all. This is all adult stem cell. It can come from muscle in your body or from your bone marrow. We take cells out with a needle. Well, if you asked me 2 years ago, is this Star Wars? Are we 5-10 years away from this ever being reality? 2 years ago, a trial was reported in Germany using your own cells. So you don't reject them. You take the cells out of your body, put them in culture, expand them, then bring them right back into your heart. So these are patients who had a heart attack, had the cells procured. 2 days later, they went right back in the artery where the heart attack occurred and infused these cells. I'm not sure if the light can give you a very good look at this. I'll certainly leave you copies. On the top is the heart terribly dilated and not working at all. At the time of the heart attack and 4 months later, no difference. Here's a heart attack that was given cell therapy, and I think you can see this is a rather dramatic normalization with the cells repairing the heart. You heard about Surmodics and their ability to coat stents with drugs. We're in the process of coating stents with stem cells, and we hope to deliver these right into the area of the heart attack or perhaps prevent the re-narrowing that those stents are designed to impede. Gene therapy sounds like an exotic and a sexy way to approach medical therapy. We think we can now use the cells as the way to get the gene therapy into the body. We have some very encouraging information that using cells enhanced with genes is even more effective than what we've seen with the cells alone. We have this protocol coming to people who undergo those mechanical device implants or coronary bypass surgery can have stem cells implanted at the time of surgery in addition to just the catheter base. So I'll conclude with, we think it's an exciting era. We think we're focusing on from high tech to simple prevention, trying to prevent the progression of this rather devastating form of disease. But we think that the university is incredibly well positioned to take a leadership role in the world. We hope to be the first in the United States to offer this therapy to residents of Minnesota in this region to see this therapy hopefully hold the promise that we think it has. I'll be happy to answer more questions.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. Any members have questions? Dr. Georgia?
Yes.
Okay. Help me with the last name, Dr. Georgopoulos. And Dr. Miller, thank you very much for your testimony. This is the technology division. Well, we're figuring out the technology members. I'll let you know that next Thursday we will be having another meeting of the division, and we'll be taking up at least two bills. Representative Broad has the BioZone investment bill. I have a research and development tax credit bill I know that Representative Pepin has a bill that's similar to mine. I've heard the VIN. We'll hear it next Thursday as well. But next Thursday, we'll have a hearing at 12:30 and be taking up those bills. Doctor, are you able to see your computer there? If it works.
Yeah, it's covering. I don't see anything there.
I think, Doctor, maybe if you could get started, if we can get the slideshow figured out here.
Something is appearing there. Okay, well, my name is Apostolos Georgopoulos. I'm professor of neuroscience, neurology and psychiatry, and the presidential, McNally presidential chair in cognitive neuroscience. So, tenured faculty at the university. I also work at the VA. I'm director of the Brain Science Center at the VA Medical Center. My presentation, I think, is quite different from the previous ones in the sense that it is very focused on high technology brain research. It's just very, very, very focused. It's not much to do with social or other issues, but how we discover how the brain works, what may be wrong in brain disease using very high technology. And, of course, the presentation is instrumental. Properly took me off the off balance with the drop my MCD here.
He tried that.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is real high tech. Yeah. Anyway, it will not be a long presentation, so I think we'll make up the time. Dr. Levine happened to be my boss for many years, so he comes to save me.
hope it works.
Yes. Alice, Dr. Levine, you know, was associate chief of research at the VA, so for many, many years, he was my direct link to the administration. So in any case, what I will be talking to you about is brain stuff and high technology that we can get hold of it. And of course you can do a lot of things with brain. You can take it out, bind and grind, you know, take pictures of it and everything. But what you will be missing would be the dynamic activity that is going on between billions of brain cells all working together to produce what you call behavior, thinking, feeling, emotion, social interaction, and so on and so forth. Oh, you got it. And we can run directly from the stick. It's called committee. This is it, yeah. Okay, well, that was a problem. You know, I should have reset it to very low resolution. So we'll be losing some things, and we'll need the lights down, if not out, you know, to make the right effect. All right, well, I started mentioning to you, and it is probably obvious, just repeated to most of you, that the brain is the most complex organ of the body. As we know, it consists of about 9 billion cells, they're called neurons. And it is not an overstatement that all behavior, perception, thought, emotion, social activity come from the continuous and massive interactions among these neurons. So this is a simple statement of fact. Now the single element is the neuron that makes up the system. But of course a cell itself, you know, is very unique, if you want. It's very peculiar. It's not like liver or heart that everything is more or less similar repeatedly. But it's the communication among these cells and their formation of ensembles of neurons that makes the brain what it is, which is a tremendously efficient information processing system. So we're trying to get a wedge into how we can identify the cooperative interactions among these diverse processing units and assess their interactions. So this is the dynamic picture I want to give to you. There's a lot of neuroscience going on, a lot of brain research. Most of it is static. I'm interested almost exclusively in the dynamic brain function. It's things that change over time, and they are all communicating and buzzing and buzzing and so on and so forth. And it so happens, I think, this line is going to interfere, but let's go to the text. Well, you probably know that neurons communicate using electrical impulses. So brain is electricity, one way or another. It's chemistry too, but for communication purposes and controlling behavior and so on and so forth, it's the electrical activity that matters. The chemistry is there to support electrical activity. And they integrate information using electrical signals generated by charged molecules, the ions, that are moving across cell membranes. So this is the whole essence of things. You have ions, sodium, potassium, calcium, moving across membrane gradients, and these generate electrical fields. And these fields are pretty decent in intensity, and you can very easily record them using electroencephalography. You probably all have heard about EEG. The EEG is easy and inexpensive, tens of thousands of dollars, but the electrical fields are getting very distorted when passing through the soft tissues. So the usefulness of the EEG as a research tool is very limited. It's actually very limited even as a clinical tool. What you can say is that there's brain death or, you know, there is some epileptical focus somewhere. But, for example, if you want to find accurately what an epileptic focus is, you have to implant subdurally, you know, sheets of EEG leads onto the cortex, onto the cerebral cortex. Just the EEG itself has not been terribly useful. Now, the magnetoencephalography, short for, you know, MEG for short, is based on the fact that as you have electrical currents, these generate magnetic fields perpendicular to the currents. This is the Maxwell sort of principle equation, you know, back in the 19th century. Now, magnetic fields have some splendid properties. They travel with the speed of light. they pass undistorted through the soft tissues, skull and all kinds of other hair and so on and so forth. And therefore, if one can measure them, their quality of the signal for research purposes is superb, is unsurpassed, is the best you can ever get. Now, there's a technical problem. Here comes the high technology. They are very, very tiny. They are of the order of 1/1,000,000,000th of the magnetic field of the Earth. Give you an idea in Tesla, which is the unit that measures magnetic fields. If you go to an MRI, you know, for whatever clinical scanner, is 1.5 Tesla. Here at the university, we have some very high fields, 9.4 Tesla. The currents, the fields we are measuring with MG are 10 to the minus 15 Tesla. You get an idea, you know, how tiny these fields are. And to go appropriately for the quality of the signal, in our work we collect it at a very high rate, 1 kilohertz, so it is every millisecond. Usually we have trials, 45 seconds, and we have about 45,000 data values to work with. Now this is very important, and all of what I will show you quickly, you know, is this one. You can do a lot of things with MEG, but what is the highest value of it? And the net result of this kind of work is the visual, which, by the way, is quite unique, you know, for this place, is the visualization of dynamic neural networks. And I stress that from the beginning. We are not interested in just beautiful structural brain pictures. We are interested to know how things are dynamically interacting. Now, such a network shows how different neural populations interact with each other. That's what we want to find out. And we're trying to find out how these networks are organized, which is connected with what functionally, how they're altered in brain disease or, say, drug addiction, and how they may be restored to their normal state for an intervention. So this whole approach serves both as a pure basic science as well as a potentially very high probability as an applied technique, both for assessing dynamic brain function and also for assessing its possible restoration. I'll show you some just of, and I don't know if we can get that light out because all of the fine stuff will be coming. Is it possible to? I mean, these really are not terribly important. It's that one that is there. Well, what you see here are a limited number, how, you know, functional networks. Of sensors. So every sensor, the 248 of them, here not all of them are shown, I'll show you one of them at the end, but you get the idea of what we call a dynamic network. The green lines indicate that cell populations, about 10,000 per turquoise sort of sensor, are synchronous. And then the red line indicates that when one goes up, the other goes down. So we have either a positive synchrony or negative synchrony. And that is one analysis. I will not go in detail on how you separate them. And you can see different, I'm sorry. Push the road back button here. So just the different tasks, just to see the different. What? I'm pushing the.
Okay. Doctor, are we getting pretty close? We have sessions starting in
about 15 minutes. That's okay. Oh, plenty of time. So anyway, quickly you can see how networks are being reassembled, you know, in different functions, so just as an idea. So this is the instrument we have at the Minneapolis Center, and it's in actual use, so you can have a patient either lying or sitting. And so all of the sensors are in that helmet that you get the patient's head. The door above it, all that big box, the cylinder is full of liquid helium to make the system work. So if you take these 248 sensors and you plot them down, this is the kind of pattern you get. And what I will show you now is something very interesting, I thought we got very recently. And here there's no real task. We have a single person, actually, that I will illustrate, just looking at the light. So it's not a matter of a complex task, but it will give us, you know, what's happening in the brain. That's why you see I needed the lights off. So however much you can see, this is the case of a normal subject. Whole brain network now, not sub-networks. You can see the formation of the sub-networks there. The strength of the lines, the color is adjusted between their maximum and minimum. But this is a pattern that you see repeatedly in normal subjects. Now, look how the pattern is in a chronic alcoholic. Okay, so this is a person who was admitted, was for chronic alcoholic, came intoxicated, and he agreed to sobriety, so stopped taking alcohol. We made sure he didn't. And we imaged his brain every day for a period of days, just trying to see what is happening in these dynamic networks as you take out, you know, the offending drug. So day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, day 7. Okay, by day 7, you know, this brain was more or less detoxified, if you want. And if you look at day 15, the pattern was very similar. And this is again the normal subject. You know, still some work to be done here. But it's amazing how these dynamic networks could be visualized and actually being sort of serving as a tool to look at the difference, what is taken to recover. So just to finish, you know, MEG is a superb, very high-tech, very expensive instrument, but offers a unique glimpse into the dynamic workings of the brain. Is uniquely suited, still the best one, for localizing epileptic seizure foci, and there is one in St. Paul, not in the university, just for clinical applications. It opens a vast horizon for studying dynamic neural processing in health and disease, and just currently we are using to study different disease processes. Now, what is the future? I think children is the future, and of course advanced old age, we're in that, getting that category. But we need one for children. We don't have one, so we're trying to find out about $2 million to make this place the first site in the world with such a facility and the only one that we can study brain and thought and behavior seamlessly from about 2 years of age to 100 plus.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I apologize we didn't have more time. We do have a session starting in 10 minutes, so thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, we're adjourned. Okay.